The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Discover a team that's always here to support you at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
A lot of reaction there to Natasha Murtagh, but what I'm going to do is I'll come back to it in a little while, if that's okay, because I want to move on for the moment. Listen, if you think you have pressure at work, right, this will stop you moaning, because I'm going to talk now to a brain surgeon, and in fact, she's Ireland's first female consultant neurosurgeon, Catherine Moran. Good morning.
Good morning, Brendan.
So, Catherine, you took up your position at the National Neurosurgical Centre in Beaumont last October. And I know you're joining a team of 12 there. But I think that you come, do you, with a particular speciality which was kind of missing from our offering in this country?
Yes. So each one of us kind of sub-specialise in a different area of neurosurgery. And what I specialise in specifically is deep brain stimulation or functional neurosurgery for patients with movement disorders or Parkinson's disease mostly.
Okay. Could you explain to us how it works?
So deep brain stimulation is basically inserting electrodes or wires deep into the brain nucleus that kind of augments the abnormal motor circuits that you get in Parkinson's disease. So about 10% of people with Parkinson's disease, they get good response from their medication, but over a few years, it kind of wanes and they start getting real trouble walking, moving. And then the deep brain stimulator can be used to basically bring you back to walking normally for kind of much longer during the day. It helps with tremor. It's a life-changing procedure for patients, especially with Parkinson's. Over the last kind of 20 years, our patients have gone to the UK for treatment, which kind of is a barrier for them because you have to travel a lot. I did my fellowship training in Bristol with Professor Steve Gill, who treated a lot of the Irish patients over the years. And when I treated people, they would maybe come for maybe six times over and back to the UK, which is obviously especially difficult when you have severe Parkinson's disease.
And so listen, the operation itself now that you have to do you have to actually drill into someone's head, so to speak?
Yes. So basically, a lot of it is accuracy. This nucleus that you're targeting is deep within the brain. It's about the size of a Tic Tac. And you need to get the electrode right at a specific spot of that nucleus to have a good effect of the basically, you're putting a little current or electricity into the brain.
Yeah.
So that you have two wires that go into two holes in the frontal bone of your skull. And then they're tunneled underneath your scalp into a battery that goes into the chest wall. And then you can augment that kind of electrical signal to that particular patient's movement problems. So you can kind of you program it in a way.
See, Catherine, I'm already thinking, and presumably I know nothing's probably routine in brain surgery, but this is kind of an elective enough procedure. It's not done for a crisis or anything, so presumably it's regarded as being at the less dramatic end of the spectrum. But presumably you make one slight error there and presumably the results can be catastrophic. Like, it must be a huge responsibility, is it?
Yeah, well, I think all of neurosurgery is like that. The brain is robust in some ways. But then when, you know, if you get a vessel or, you know, you need to be very accurate for you to have good results, especially when it's an elective surgery.
And look, I've probably read too much Henry Marsh, but like the way he presents it is that, like, at times you are almost like it is almost like playing God in a way. But also the unexpected can happen when you're in there and you need to make these decisions about, you know, life, death, or life-changing stuff that if I do this, I could possibly save the person, but it could have this other knock-on effect. Is that?
Yes, and that's kind of a lot of the, if you have a complication in neurosurgery, the consequences can be different for, the outcomes can be different for different patients in terms of if a complication arises, is the person left, you know, are they, do they have weakness? You know, is their mentality changed? You know, the neurosurgery, when you're operating on the brain, it is high stakes stuff.
Yeah. And are you able to prepare and kind of go through in your head each operation, or is it a question
you
have to take it? Yeah.
A lot of our surgeries are, especially with deep brain stimulation, a lot of the planning is before the surgery is maybe can take, especially with deep brain stimulation, can take as long as the surgery itself. So DBS is kind of, there's a lot of technology involved in terms of the planning software that we use to locate this nucleus really accurately. We also use robotics to help guide the electrode to exactly where it needs to be. But a lot of it is planned before the day.
And how do you deal with the pressure?
I think good friends and family help.
Yeah.
And good colleagues. I mean, you do work in a team. So there's always, you know, 12 heads if you want to ask questions. You know, we work together, we discuss things. It's a small community, if you like, neurosurgery. There's 13 neurosurgeons now in Dublin and 4 in Cork. So we've all worked with each other for years. So, your colleagues are
I can
really
imagine.
Important.
Yeah, because they're the only people who really understand what you go through, I bet. And is it something that takes over your whole life? I mean, I presume you can't just like clock in, do the job and go home, forget about it.
You do definitely go home and still you're still thinking about maybe what you're going to do tomorrow or what happened that day. You're calling in to make sure everything is okay. You're going in at the weekends to make sure, you know, your post-operative patients are doing well. So it is hard to clock out, but it's I think you get over time, you get, you know, a bit better at it. You kind of have to at some stage to, you know, function well and kind of, keep optimistic and keep fresh.
Yeah, I bet. You mentioned there about calling into the patients then as well and checking in on them. So presumably you have to have some kind of I know a lot of people will never see their surgeon before or after an operation sometimes, but presumably you have to have some kind of a relationship with this person or meet them or...
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Especially, you know, it's, you know, people can, they've probably heard of patients having, you know, a hip procedure or their appendix, but when it comes to the brain, there's a lot of explaining to do. And I think, you know, once people understand what's going to happen, just in terms of timelines and what to expect after surgery, that's really important. So I would, you know, we would definitely meet all of our patients and go through everything as much as we can, not to try and scare them, but to try and get them in the picture.
Yeah.
You know, show them diagrams, show the patients the actual electrodes that's going to go in and the battery and what to expect. Because once they have an idea of what's going to happen afterwards, everything is a little less daunting.
Yeah, because people must be very scared at the idea of someone going into their brain.
Yeah.
It must be kind of draining for you. Presumably you're dealing with people as well sometimes who are in like fairly catastrophic situations, or maybe somebody whose life has been altered after procedure and everything. That must be tricky, is it?
Yeah, so a lot of our work, about 70% of what we do is kind of urgent or emergency work in terms of brain trauma or brain hemorrhages or tumours. And, you know, you really need to kind of, again, spend time with them, spend time with their families. And, you know, sometimes you have to, you know, try and make, you know, recovery plans with them. We have really good backup and we work closely with the Dunleary Rehabilitation Centre. But a lot of neurosurgery as well is some of it for us is quite routine. So you kind of, you're trying to explain that as well, that this is obviously when someone's getting a craniotomy to have a tumour removed, for them, you know, it's not routine, but for us, it's what we do every day.
And am I right in thinking some people are awake for some brain procedures?
Yes. So traditionally, actually, people were operated on awake for deep brain stimulation, but we're kind of changing that, so because that people didn't want to go ahead with it if they were going to be awake.
I don't blame them, yeah.
So some centres still do it awake, but we have basically with the software we're using and the preoperative kind of MRI imaging has improved so much over the last 20 years that we're able to do it asleep or under anaesthetic.
And the wakefulness was so that you could check how they were doing test reactions and stuff.
Yeah? Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But we still do some tumours. So parts of your brain we call eloquent. So, you know, you have frontal lobes and temporal lobes, and particular parts of those lobes can be even taking a small piece of that brain away can have a much bigger effect than if you're a little bit more forward. So doing awake craniotomies for tumours in those eloquent areas, we still do.
Wow, okay. But then you take all that and most people are thinking, I neither want to be on the giving or the receiving end of any of that. I believe you're at your happiest when you are in theatre operating.
Yes, yeah. I think most surgeons, you know, that's their kind of favourite part of the day or favourite part of the week is when you're just, it is stressful, but the actual, when you're actually doing the surgery itself, you're quite zen. You're just concentrating on what's in front of you, you know, and it's where you want to be. So definitely at your happiest when you're operating. So we're always trying to get more operating space.
Well, yeah, yeah. Yeah, like you're in your flow almost when you're in there. Yeah, so almost not thinking, but obviously thinking very, very fast as well. When did you decide you wanted to be a brain surgeon? Like what's the draw to such a, as you say, high stakes kind of thing?
Ooh. Well, I studied at UCD, so I didn't have much exposure to neurosurgery because as a kind of an undergrad, but it was I loved learning and I loved reading any of the neuroanatomy or any neurophysiology books. They were what kind of would keep me up at night just going through them. And it was kind of something that you never stop learning about. So I knew that in 20 years' time, there's still so much more to know about the brain that it would keep you going for a whole career, which is true. And then I loved surgery. So when I was training in UCD, standing, if you were holding a retractor, kind of assisting in a surgery, even though you just kind of stand there, you wouldn't be doing much just holding a retractor, but for hours, that was exactly where I wanted to be. So I put the two together and went for neurosurgery and never looked back.
and listen, this will be reassuring for people. It takes 20 years training really to get there, does it?
Yeah, so that's once you kind of do your medical training in medical school and then you go on to kind of general surgery training, and then you go into neurosurgery speciality training for about 6-7 years, and then you do kind of fellowship training in whatever subspecialty you're going to do. So I subspecialize in spine and the deep brain stimulation. So yeah, 20 years.
And listen, you were around the world a lot and everything. Did you always want to come back? Because I suppose the impression we have that people who are operating at that high level like you can make fortunes, say, in America compared to here or whatever.
I always did want to. Yeah, I always wanted to come back and work in Ireland. I think the health system, you know, it gets a lot of slack all the time, but it's a great place to work. I mean, the colleagues I work with in Beaumont were second to none.
Yeah. And you are, I don't know how relevant it is in one way, but it's very relevant in another way that you're Ireland's first female consultant neurosurgeon. Is that a surprise or are there not many women in neurosurgery in general?
So in the UK, there's about 300 and something neurosurgeons, about 10% of them are women. So it's growing slowly. I guess it wasn't something that was in the forefront of my mind while I was training. It's, I guess when you get the position, you're like, okay, right, I'm the first. And I'd like to kind of promote. And I think once people see somebody in a position, a woman in that position, that you can, people, it more normalizes it and people would kind of go into it quicker.
Did you have role models, female role models, when you were coming up?
Yeah, so especially one particular surgeon I worked with before I started in Beaumont. I spent a few weeks in Harvard, and she was, you know, I went to her house for dinner, and, you know, she just took me around, and I was thinking about training there, but I wanted to come home and train in Dublin. And just kind of having a woman who was, you know, friendly and normal and chatting and, you know, giving her what the day to day is like, that was important. And then I've had other colleagues in the UK when I worked there who were certainly role models, and maybe not totally consciously, but subconsciously.
Yeah. And listen, I want to be very careful how I say this now. I'm not saying they should think this, but do people often expect the neurosurgeon to be a man?
They do sometimes. I mean, not always. Certainly not the majority. But I think, you know, you live in society. You know, people have various attitudes, and, you know, different generations think differently. And I think, once they kind of get it in their head, it's fine. But it just takes a little bit of time. But it's something that changes.
Yeah. And listen, before we finish up, I know that the deep brain stimulation is very, very expensive. And Beaumont is currently fundraising, isn't it, for the service. Is that something that seems unusual to you, that, like, presumably out in America, do they have to go out with the begging bowl for hospitals and stuff, or how does it work?
Well, we're getting, in fairness, very good support from the HSE and from Beaumont for kind of capital expenditure. But just going forward, it's a tech heavy, expensive service in terms of just the actual system itself. I worked in the UK. I think, you know, most hospitals would do fundraising just for extra, you know, equipment that makes things our lives better and makes the patient treatment kind of easier. But we are getting good support from the HSE. They've been planning on bringing this to Ireland for some years, and we're getting there. We have the neurology side of the team is in the Mater, and they're up and running. There's about a team of eight, and the neurologists there, Richard Walsh and Tim Lynch, who's been working on to getting this back to Ireland for a number of years. So we're getting good support, but it is expensive, and it's going to be expensive to keep going.
Okay, well, Catherine Moore, I think I speak for all of us, judging by the text here, when I say we're very glad you came home to Ireland, and people delighted to have you on board. And you are, that's extraordinary stuff, and you're an extraordinary person. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye, Catherine Moore. Let's take a break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.